Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into a really foundational topic in biology, the history of evolutionary thought and specifically natural selection. Our guide for this is a great lecture series from Dr. Hoffman. And actually, he gave some really good advice for anyone trying to absorb this stuff.
Oh, yeah. What was that?
He basically said, look, the slides are mostly pictures. They're online. Focus on listening on the, you know, the live performance. Take your initial notes, but then refine them later using the recording because you'll need to pause. It actually takes longer to process than the lecture itself.
That makes sense. Don't get bogged down and just copying images.
Exactly. Oh, and track the slide numbers. He mentioned that the little red number helps connect your notes back to the visuals later. Super practical.
Okay, good tip. So our mission today, then, is to kind of unpack that historical background leading up to Darwin and really nail down natural selection.
Let's start with that core idea, evolution. It's this huge concept connecting just the sheer variety of life you see, like Dr. Hoffman's example of that camouflaged caterpillar, with this underlying unity. Everything's related.
Yeah. And it's wild when you think about it. All life, from us to bacteria, shares these fundamental characteristics. What, seven major ones? Like using energy, having order.
Right.
And that's because we all trace back billions of years to one successful ancestor.
Oh.
Evolution is the story of that connection, the story of change linking unity and diversity.
But for ages, that idea of change just wasn't on the table. The dominant view, even among scientists for a long time, was fixity of species.
Right. Everything was thought to have been created, boom, all at once, and species just didn't change. Evolution, which really just means to change, wasn't the thinking.
So what started shaking that belief?
Evidence. Actual physical evidence from the ground, paleontology.
Fossils.
Exactly. Mineralized bits of former life found in these rock layers, strata.
And those layers are like a timeline, right? Lowest is oldest, highest is newest.
Precisely. And that immediately caused a problem for the created all at once idea.
Because if everything appeared at the same time,
you'd expect to find all the fossils mixed together way down in the oldest layer. But that's not what they found. Different layers had totally different sets of fossils.
Which brings us to Cuvier. Georges Cuvier, the father of paleontology.
Yeah, Cuvier. He saw extinction clearly in the fossil record species that were there in older layers, just weren't in the newer ones.
Okay, so extinction maybe fits with creationism? Species just die out sometimes?
Sort of. But the real kicker was the new species appearing in those upper newer layers. Where did they come from? Cuvier documented this, but he couldn't really square it with his creationist beliefs. He saw the change, but didn't have the explanation.
And explaining that change needed more than just fossils. It needed time. Lots of time.
Enter the geologists, Lyell and Hutton. Darwin devoured their work on the Beagle.
What was their big idea?
They looked at things like mountains, canyons, the Grand Canyon, and said these weren't formed instantly. They're the result of slow, gradual, everyday processes, erosion, uplift acting over vast, vast stretches of time.
Which sounds obvious now, but back then,
revolutionary. Most people thought the Earth was maybe a few thousand years old. Lyell and Hutton started talking millions, still way off the actual 4.5 billion years, but conceptually, huge. It gave evolution the time it needed to actually happen.
Okay, so the stage is set. People are seeing change in the rocks. They're starting to grasp deep time. But explaining how life changes, that's the scientific leap. And Dr. Hoffman highlighted this key difference, right? Science versus faith.
Mm-hmm. Science demands belief based on evidence. And crucially, you have to be willing to change your beliefs if the evidence points another way. Faith, by contrast, is belief often without or sometimes even despite the evidence.
So who first tried to offer a scientific explanation for evolution?
That would be Lamarck.
Yeah.
Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. He absolutely believed species evolved, and he actually proposed a mechanism, a hypothesis for how.
Okay, so what was his hypothesis, even if it was wrong?
He thought traits acquired during an organism's life through use or disuse, basically experience, could be passed directly to offspring.
Ah, the giraffe example. Stretching its neck makes the neck longer, and then its babies are born with slightly longer necks.
That's the classic idea. It's intuitive in a way, but it's wrong.
Yeah, Dr. Hoffman used the bonsai tree, right? You can force a tree to be tiny its whole life, but its seeds will grow into normal-sized trees. Or think about bodybuilders.
Exactly. Your kids don't inherit your muscles just because you worked out. Acquired traits aren't passed on genetically like that.
But Lamarck was important because he asked the right question and tried to answer it scientifically.
Absolutely. He framed the problem. Which leads us, finally, to Darwin. And it's funny, that famous Beagle voyage in the 1830s, it wasn't even about evolution initially.
Right. They were map makers, cartographers charting South America. Darwin just tagged along as the naturalist.
Yeah, he was the onboard biologist, basically. And he started the trip as a creationist. But 5 years of observing wildlife everywhere, the Galapagos being the famous spot plus reading Lyell and Hutton, it changed his thinking completely.
And the key takeaway, the reason Darwin is so famous, isn't just that he thought evolution happened. Lots of people are starting to think that.
It's the how. His explanation, natural selection.
That book title says it all, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection.
That's the critical part.
Yeah.
By means of natural selection. That was his mechanism.
Okay, so let's break down natural selection based on what Darwin observed. Dr. Hoffman laid out two key observations. First, variation. You look at any population, like beetles, and individuals aren't identical. Some are bigger, smaller, different colors. There's variety. And crucially, some of that variation can be passed down. It's heritable.
Right. So individuals differ, and those differences can be inherited. This means they have different levels of fitness or suitability to their environment.
And then the second observation, think of like a fungus puffing out millions of spores or a fish laying countless eggs.
Overproduction. Species produce way, way more offspring than can possibly survive. The environment can't support them all, so.
Competition, a struggle for existence.
Exactly. So if you have variation, inheritability, and overproduction leading to competition, the logical conclusion, the inference, is natural selection.
Individuals whose inherited traits make them better suited to their environment tend to survive longer and leave more offspring than others.
And over generations, those advantageous traits become more common in the population. The population becomes better adapted. That is evolution by natural selection. It's the only known mechanism that consistently leads to adaptation, to increased fitness.
And now we know the basis for that heritability is DNA, right? The instructions for building the proteins that give us our traits. Darwin didn't know about genes, but he saw the pattern.
Correct. He figured out the macro-level process without knowing the micro-level details of genetics.
Okay, let's make this concrete with some examples Dr. Hoffman used. The Galapagos finches are classic.
Yeah, these birds, all closely related, ended up on different islands with different food sources. And their beaks evolved dramatically.
Some got thin, pointy beaks for insects.
Others got these massive, tough beaks for cracking hard seeds. The selection pressure was intense. If your beak wasn't right for the food on your island, you couldn't eat. You died. Simple as that.
Or the soapberry bugs. That's a great one. They originally ate a native fruit with a really thick rind.
So they needed a long nose, a proboscis, to pierce it.
But then humans introduced a new plant, the golden rain tree, with much thinner fruit. And what happened to the bugs' noses?
They actually got shorter, on average. Because the super long nose, while great for the thick old fruit, was maybe more fragile, more likely to break on the thin new fruit. The slightly shorter, sturdier noses worked fine for the thin fruit and were less of a liability. Selection favored shorter.
Wow. And then the really sobering example, antibiotic resistance.
Mm-hmm. This is natural selection happening right now in hospitals, in us, when we use an antibiotic.
It's a massive selection event. It kills almost all the bacteria.
Except any random individuals that happen to have a mutation, a genetic variation that makes them resistant, they survive.
And then they reproduce. And the next generation is full of resistant bacteria. The drug stops working.
It's a huge problem. And Dr. Hoffman pointed out the economic issue. There's less profit incentive for drug companies to constantly develop new antibiotics, which are short-term cures, compared to drugs for chronic conditions you take for life.
So we're creating this intense selection pressure, but we're falling behind in the evolutionary arms race. That's concerning.
Very. It risks taking us back to a pre-antibiotic era. Simple infections could become deadly again.
Now, it's worth mentioning, Darwin wasn't totally alone in figuring this out, right?
No. Alfred Russel Wallace, an amazing naturalist, he independently came up with the exact same idea, natural selection, while working in Southeast Asia.
But Darwin gets the credit.
Wallace, apparently out of deep respect for Darwin's decades of work, kind of deferred to him when it came time to publish. So Darwin published first and became primarily associated with the idea. But Wallace deserves huge credit too.
Okay, so we have the mechanism. What about the broader evidence for common ancestry, this idea that all life is related?
That's where homology comes in. Similarity due to shared ancestry.
Like the bones in our arms.
Exactly. Humans, cats, whales, bats. Our forelimbs are used for totally different things, throwing, walking, swimming, flying. But look at the bones inside. Same basic set, same pattern.
One bone, two bones, little blobby bones, finger bones.
That underlying structure was inherited from a common mammalian ancestor. The modifications happen through natural selection for different functions, but the blueprint is shared.
You even see it in embryos, right? Dr. Hoffman mentioned human and chick embryos both have tails early on.
Yep, a postnatal tail. It's a leftover from our shared vertebrate ancestor that had a tail as an adult. We just usually lose it during development.
That's homology. But then there's analogy.
Right. Analogy is similarity due to similar function, but not shared ancestry. It's convergent evolution.
Things evolving similar solutions independently.
Like the sugar glider in Australia and the flying squirrel in North America. One's a marsupial, one's a placental mammal, very distantly related in the grand scheme.
But they look almost identical, those skin flaps for gliding.
They evolved those gliding membranes completely independently because gliding was a huge advantage for living in trees in their respective environments.
Uh-huh.
Similar selection pressures led to similar solutions. That's analogy.
And the fossil record ties this all together, placing these organisms on the tree of life.
Mm-hmm. Darwin sketched the first phylogenetic tree in his notebook, showing how lineages branch off speciation and how some end extinction. Fossils help us fill in the gaps on that tree.
Dr. Hoffman had that great ankle bone example.
Oh, yeah, the astragalus bone. Most land mammals have one pulley bump on it, but whales, dolphins, marine mammals,
and even toad ungulates like hippos and pigs,
they both have two bumps, the double pulley. That unique shared trait strongly suggested whales were more closely related to hippos than to other mammals.
Which seemed crazy, a whale related to a hippo.
But then they found fossils. Transitional fossils of early whale ancestors that lived on land looked a bit like weird wolves or deer. And they had that same double pulley ankle bone. It cinched the connection. Whales evolved from land mammals closely related to hippos. The fossils confirmed the prediction from anatomy.
It's just layers upon layers of evidence.
It really is. So, to recap, evolution is fundamentally change over time. Natural selection, based on heritable variation and differential survival, is the primary engine driving adaptation. And all this evidence, from fossils to anatomy to DNA, links the incredible diversity of life back to a single common origin.
It's an amazing story. And thinking about Darwin, his whole world-changing theory came together during what was essentially a long, tedious map-making voyage on the Beagle. It wasn't designed to be some grand evolutionary quest.
Just good observation during a routine mission.
So here's a final thought for you. What huge, maybe even kind of boring-sounding scientific data-gathering project is happening right now? Maybe mapping the ocean floor, analyzing signals from space, sequencing genomes on a massive scale. What seemingly routine mission today might be collecting the puzzle pieces that 150 years from now, someone puts together into a completely new fundamental understanding of life or the universe?
That's a fascinating question to ponder. What unnoticed details hold the next big revolution?
Something to think about. That's all for this deep dive. Thanks for joining us.